All right, let's go ahead and get started. Well, good afternoon, everyone. Oh, come on, come on, come on. Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon.
That's right. If you're a good audience, I'll let you go to Ask the Experts later and have some free drinks on us. How's that? No? Yeah, okay. There you go. All right. Okay, so quick show of hands. How many of you already have deployed Exchange 2013? All right, how many of you are on 2010? Ooh, awesome. 2007. All right, anybody on 2003 or earlier? Okay, all right. So obviously, we're here talking about Exchange Server 2013 tips and tricks, so we're not going to be focusing on the other versions, but if you are running one of those other versions, there's still a lot to get out of this because there is a lot of new and different things in Exchange 2013. In fact, as you see, as we get along and we start talking about the things that are gone and the things that are new, I think you'll find that this version of Exchange really represents the starting point of a very new paradigm for the Exchange Server product itself. Yes, it has the same name. Yes, we have a lot of the same terminology that we use to describe a lot of the components. But under the covers, in particular, a lot of the core architectural components that we had historically in previous versions are gone and replaced with all new rewritten versions of those components inside 2013. Now, how many of you have been to one of my tips and tricks sessions before? All right, just a few of you. Oh, that's great. So I like having a new crowd, too. So if you haven't been to one of these, it's pretty much just a bunch of tips that I myself come up with that I think will be useful for customers deploying Exchange 2013. Some are things that are little-known things that we haven't had a chance to document yet, or they're new things that we've learned, or things that we're seeing out in the field, or just things that are kind of important because some of the stuff that we're talking about is just brand new. So there's a lot of stuff in there like that as well. So we will start out a little bit slow. I always like to start out with a section that I call basics to sort of level set everything and get everybody up to speed on where we are and what we've done. So in terms of the basics, I know a lot of you already know some of these things. You know, for example, that we RTM'd Exchange 2013 last year on October 11th, 10/11/12, using the American date standard. It's been generally available since December. Generally available means that you can purchase it, so it's been on the price list since last December. It's been downloadable worldwide. Service general availability, that happened in late February. Service general availability is when the Office 365 service went to the final version of Exchange 2013. So that's when we went to the cloud with that product. And we have released one cumulative update, which those of you who have deployed Exchange 2013, hopefully you've already downloaded and run, in particular because we require it for coexistence. And there is another cumulative update that's coming out. We'll talk about our update strategy. But I do want to point out there is one that is coming out. It is imminent. And we have talked about at this event and other events about a few of the things that are going to be in there. And I'll reinforce a couple of those as well. Now, as with prior versions of Exchange, it comes in multiple editions. We have the standard and the enterprise edition. With CU1 and earlier, there is a big difference. The enterprise edition is limited to a maximum of 50 mounted databases per server. In CU2, we're going to be increasing that limit back to 100 databases per enterprise server. But as was the case with Exchange 2010, the standard edition of 2013 is limited to 5 mounted databases per server. And we say mounted because you can actually create many more databases than you can mount. There's two limits that we have. One is in the store and one is a jet limit. So the store limit will actually allow you to create well over 200 databases on every server. But the jet limit, or the database engine limit, is only going to allow you to attach or mount 50 of those. Now, or 50 in CU1, 100 in CU2 and later. Now, when we say mounted or attached, that could be an active or passive database. So active databases are mounted and attached to the store process for client activity. Passive databases, they're also mounted, but they're attached to the replication service. So they're mounted in a special recovery mode, but they're attached to the replication service, and they will count as a mounted database against that limit. The only type of database that does not count against this limit is that one special recovery database that you can create on all of your Exchange servers. You get one recovery database per server. And again, that limit will be increased to 100 when we release CU2. A lot of people have asked us, how come it wasn't 100 at RTM? How come we had to wait till CU2? Well, as you'll see as we talk about some of the architectural changes, We have replaced core functionality inside of Exchange, including the information store, the search technology that we use, and we've also added a whole bunch of new code, features like inference, features like managed availability and whatnot. And so it took us a while to be able to get all that stuff where we felt comfortable supporting that many number of databases. So we've done a lot of validation, we've done some code fixes in a few areas, and we're very comfortable supporting 100 mounted databases per server with CU2 that's coming. Now, there's also this hybrid edition, this third edition, and we actually had the hybrid edition in 2010 as well. That's where it got introduced. But Exchange 2013 has native hybrid capabilities. So what that means is that the 2013 hybrid server is really just there for customers who are running 2007 or 2010, and they want to do a hybrid deployment with Office 365. In that case, they would deploy an Exchange 2013 hybrid server, which is pretty much nothing other than downloading Exchange 2013, CU1 or later, installing that, and then contacting Office 365 support for the free hybrid key that comes with that. You put the key in, and then you've got your hybrid server. And you can use that server for the connectivity between the on-premises infrastructure and the cloud. But if you use that server for any other purpose, if you put mailboxes on it, public folders, you make an expansion server, or do anything to that server that is outside the scope of the hybrid relationship, you would actually need to buy a real server license for it. But as long as you just use that server within the scope of the hybrid agreement, then you provide the hardware, we provide the software for free in that case. So again, though, the hybrid server in 2013, if you are doing 2013 and you want to do a hybrid deployment, you don't need a special hybrid key. 2013 has those capabilities built into the server itself. Now, let's talk about cumulative updates. This represents a significant change in the way that we service this product. Okay, so when we talk about servicing Exchange, we're talking about our approach to releasing updates, new features, and hotfixes, and things like that. So with Exchange 2010 as an example, we would release periodically service packs. And in between service packs, we would release what we call these roll-up updates. And these were basically a roll-up or a collection of updates that we had previously individually released for Exchange. So the roll-up update paradigm is gone. We don't use that anymore. Now we have a servicing model that uses what we call cumulative updates. And cumulative updates are much more like service packs than they are roll-up updates. They're the full product, for example, so when you download them, it's not just a finite set of updates, it's the entire new product. And just like a service pack, when you deploy one of these cumulative updates, under the covers, setup is actually removing the existing product and reinstalling the new one when it's done. So it's very similar to service packs in that regard. Now, in terms of service packs themselves, we're not at a point where we're ready to start talking about them. It's still a little too early. Again, we are still working with the cumulative updates. We've already released CU1. I mentioned earlier that CU2 is imminent, and we will have future cumulative updates as we go through our servicing model. Now, the updates, the plan is to issue them quarterly. Okay, there's four quarters, which means each quarter has 3 months in a year. Some folks, though, have mistakenly misinterpreted that to mean we're going to release an update every 3 months. No, we're not. We're releasing quarterly. We could release an update on the first day of one quarter and the last day of the next quarter, which would be effectively about a six-month time window there. So don't expect updates, these CUs, to come out every 3 months. They come out quarterly, which, again, could be a much wider range. Now, there's also this concept of security updates. We have committed to delivering security updates that do not require any particular level of CU. So the security updates, if there are any for Exchange 2013, haven't been any yet, but if there are any, we will release them as separate updates. And we will release multiple versions of them. So say, for instance, CU2 has been released. We will release a security update for CU2, for CU1, and RTM. In other words, we won't force you to install a cumulative update just so you can get a security update. We will give you security updates for whatever version that you are running of Exchange. And interim updates we'll also still be able to deliver as well. So if you've ever worked with Premier Support or called in to get your own individual hotfix, we still have that capability as well. And just as before you can move forward, you would need to uninstall an interim update before doing a cumulative or a security update after that. In terms of support, cumulative updates will be supported for a period of 3 months after the next CU is released. So CU1's already out. That came out on April 2nd. CU2 is not out yet. But when CU2 is released, that means CU1 will be supported for a period of 3 months after that date. And since it's possible to have an entire six-month window, it could be possible that you have a nine-month support period for your cumulative updates. Of course, that will vary from update to update depending on our release schedule, but we're very careful about releasing things now only when they're ready and not beforehand. So there's a lot of benefits to this model, but I don't mind saying that the benefits are really only there if you are able to keep up with our release cadence. But if you are able to keep up with the release cadence and periodically, once a quarter, install these cumulative updates, then you get a lot of benefits. The primary benefit is that before we will release any cumulative update to any of you to install, we will run it first, not just in our test and dog food labs, but we'll also run it in Office 365 first. So we will test it and vet it at a greater scale than we've ever been able to do. And you'll know that it's been very well-exercised code well before you install it on any of your servers as well. So that is also a huge benefit. Now, some of the downsides to this new model, and by that I mean moving from roll-up updates to cumulative updates, one of the downsides is because it's just like a service pack, that means some of the customizations you might do to your server would be lost. So in particular, things like your web.config files, those would be overwritten. Any other config files that you change inside of our bin folder where you can manipulate the managed code services that we have, any of those changes that you make would get overwritten by the next cumulative update. So you're going to want to have very good change management control over your systems so that not only you document the changes, but perhaps you have scripts that can recreate those changes after your next cumulative update has been installed. So for those of you who have custom changes and you've gone through service pack upgrades, that's exactly what I'm talking about. It's that same process that you'll have to do through. One other big change that we're doing is, unlike the roll-up updates, which we didn't increment the build number, every time we issue a cumulative update, we are incrementing the server build number. So at a glance, you'll be able to look at the versions of the servers that you're running and know what versions of Exchange that they're running on. So as you saw earlier, CU1 is build 620.29. You'd know that at a glance just by looking at that in the Exchange Admin Center or through PowerShell. You can get that information. So that's another benefit as well. The only other thing I'll point out here is, in terms of the installation process, generally it should be bulletproof, but we can't guarantee that it's going to succeed every single time. So if you do run into some sort of failure scenario where, for whatever reason, the CU did not complete successfully, you'll actually need to go back to the version of software that you had originally on that server. So if you're going from CU1 to CU2, you got to go back to the CU1 software and then run setup with the recover server process to get you back on a stable CU1 platform, and then you can move forward with the CU2 install again. So just keep that in mind. It's a recover server back off process if anything goes wrong during the installation process. All right, let's talk about some general stuff. And the general stuff, for those of you already running 2013, and maybe those of you who've already looked into this, it might not be too much of a surprise, but I still wanted to sort of give you an inventory of all of the things that are now gone in Exchange 2013, in part because the list is kind of long, and secondly, because the list has some fairly significant things on it, things like the hub transport server role, the unified messaging server role, the legacy CAS server role. All those things as individual server roles are gone, and we're just left with the two roles, CAS and mailbox. And CAS, of course, is a brand new server that we introduced. Yes, it has the same name as the prior server, but it's all brand new code doing all new and different things. And all those other server roles, the legacy CAS role, the hub, the unified messaging server role, they're all now running inside the mailbox server role. And that's why we just have the two roles. A couple of you have asked about the Edge transport server role this event. And we have committed to delivering an Exchange 2013 Edge transport server. We have not said when. We've said it'll be post-RTM, so it'll be sometime later. We've already RTM, but it's not now, so it'll be later. But we have committed to that. So there will be an Edge transport server coming soon, or eventually, I should say. But in the meantime, you can very easily use an Exchange 2010 Edge Transport Server, or if you're on 2007, a 2007 Edge Transport Server as well. Some of the other things that are gone, the exchange management console, that MMC snap-in, it's gone. We don't use that anymore. Also, the exchange control panel, which we just introduced in Exchange 2010, is not 100% gone, but 100% replaced with the Exchange Admin Center. And you can tell its ECP is still there because we still use the ECP virtual directory for the Exchange Admin Center as well. But ECP, that interface itself, is gone. And the interface that you see now, both the Outlook web app experience and the Exchange Admin Center, are all brand new interfaces that we created specifically for 2013, and I'll show you a couple of cool things you can do with OWA in a bit. RPC over TCP connectivity for Outlook clients, gone. The only way we allow an Outlook client in MAPI mode to connect is RPC over HTTP, or what we branded as Outlook Anywhere. Now, some folks have taken that to mistakenly believe that we no longer use MAPI. That is not true at all. We're still using MAPI. Both of those transport mechanisms were always MAPI-based. Anytime we talk about RPCs from an exchange client to the server, those are MAPI RPCs. We don't allow that traffic to go over a TCP connection anymore, which is typically what your internally domain join clients are going to do. We now only allow it to go over HTTP. We intentionally turned Outlook into an HTTP client so that it could benefit from some of the high availability and some of the site resilience changes that we made. So, no more RPC over TCP, no more support for Outlook 2003 as well. So, all of your clients will need to be Outlook 2007 or later. And of course, as you might imagine, you get the best experience with Outlook 2013, as there's some features that will only light up in that version of Outlook. Now, some big ones. The legacy information store, and by that, I mean the same store.exe that's been in Exchange since Exchange 4.0 and all the way through Exchange 2010, is gone. And in its place is a brand new store that we call the managed store. We call it managed store because it's written in managed code, C#. And it's not only giving you better scalability, but it's also introducing this concept of failure isolation. We use a worker process model now. Before, we just had that one process, store.exe. It was monolithic, it was huge, and it was a single point of failure. All your databases were attached to that process. In the worker process model that we use now, every single database has its own worker process associated with it that provides the RPC endpoint and the database cache for it. And speaking of database cache, the dynamic buffer algorithm that we used to use for caching is also gone. How many of you are familiar with the dynamic buffer algorithm? This is so funny. Usually when I say that, not a single hand goes up. But watch this. How many of you are familiar with, oh no, the store is eating all my memory? There we go. There's the hands. That's right. So that was by design. That's the dynamic buffer algorithm at work. The idea there was that you bought that memory to be used. And so Exchange, the store process in particular, was specifically coded to consume all available memory and only give memory back if the operating system asked us for it. And that was actually a very complex chunk of code. And by chunk, I mean literally hundreds of thousands of lines of code to do that. That algorithm is gone. And in its place is now a static database caching algorithm that is based on the amount of memory in the box, the number of databases on the box, and if you've configured it, the value of maximum active databases, which is a cap that you can put on a server to limit the number of active databases it can mount. By default, there is just a limit that we talked about earlier, but you can cap that lower if you need to. And we will only calculate that cache when the information store service is started. And so what that means now, in the new Exchange, if you add a database, remove a database, add or remove database copies, you will actually need to restart the store service and have it recalculate the cache. We don't do it dynamically anymore. It's a static calculation at startup only. And in CU1, by the way, in the UI, if you are using the Exchange Admin Center to make more databases, we will pop up a dialog that tells you you need to restart the store service so that the cache can be recalculated. If you don't restart the store service, you will have undersized caches, and your databases will not perform properly. So just remember, you need to do that now. Microsoft Search, which we used in Exchange 2007, We had Microsoft Search 2.0. Then we went to 2.1. Then in Exchange 2010, we went to 3.0 and then 3.1 later on. And then we threw that all away because back in 2008, Microsoft purchased a company out of Norway called Fast. And they also had a search technology called Fast as well. And after we purchased it, Fast became our property. We kept the development team, and they're still in Oslo working for us now. And that search technology is owned by Office. And as you know, Exchange is part of Office, which means now all across Office, so SharePoint, Exchange, and anywhere else we decide to use it, we are now using a new common search engine called Search Foundation. I'll talk about that in a little bit as well. Some other big things that are gone, public folder databases, they're gone. And along with them is public folder replication, also gone. Now, there are modern public folders, which I'll talk about on the next slide in a bit, but the old legacy public folder databases do not exist. There's only two types of databases. One is going to be a regular mailbox database. The other is going to be a recovery database. No more public folder databases. The legacy Outlook web app, and by legacy Outlook web app, I mean the one that we just completely rewrote in Exchange 2010 after throwing away the one we completely rewrote in Exchange 2007, which was replacing the one we threw away from 2003. I think we might have an OWA rewrite addiction problem in Exchange because we seem to rewrite it over and over. But actually, there's a reason for that madness. We're doing it, obviously, in this era of BYOD. We've specifically rewritten it so that we can have a good experience on multiple devices. So that could mean your phone, it could mean your tablet, it could mean a laptop, it could mean a desktop. We optimize, and in fact, we will detect now inside of Outlook Web App, we'll try to detect what you're on, and we will give you a different view depending on the screen resolution and size and the form factor that we detect you're on. We wouldn't have been able to do that with the 2010 version, and that was one of the reasons that we threw that out and started fresh with a new one as well. The virus scanning API, that's also gone. This was the API that we allowed third-party antivirus vendors to hook into the databases, hook right into the store, and do antivirus scanning and whatnot. That is gone. But that's a good thing, and I'll explain why. The first reason it's good is now, because vSAPI is gone, that was the last third-party hook into the store. Okay, so what that means now, third-party applications cannot get into the store. They can't get into the store process, and they can't get into the databases themselves. So that brings stability, because only our code can go into those areas. The other reason is there's lots of other ways to catch viruses. As long as you've got antivirus software at all points of ingress and egress, you will be fine. And if you do need to do something like a scheduled scan, we do have on-demand scanning through Exchange Web Services. You'll just need to buy a third-party product that uses that. If you don't want the on-demand scanning, we do have built-in antivirus and anti-malware in Exchange. It is basic in terms of the features it gives you, but it can be replaced or augmented with the third-party solution as well. So the fact that vSAPI is gone is really not that big of a deal. And in fact, it might surprise you to know that Microsoft internally has not run antivirus software on our mailbox servers for well over a decade. In fact, it was, I think, Exchange 5.0 was the last time we had antivirus softwares on our internal servers. Now, our situation is a little unique. We're always running a slightly different version of the store because we're dog-fooding stuff constantly. And so our position is it's not really fair for the antivirus softwares to keep up with our churn. So technically, there is no antivirus software products that we can buy because of the uniqueness of how we run. But we haven't had a compromise or an outbreak or anything that we've had to deal with as a result of not having it on our mailbox servers, and I don't think any of you are going to be at risk as a result of this being gone as well. So, managed folders are gone. The ability to remove individual server roles is also gone. So if you deploy a multi-role server and cast a mailbox on both roles on the same physical server, and then you decide later on you want to get rid of CAS, you actually have to uninstall Exchange and then reinstall just the mailbox role. And then the UM lookup's doing automatic speech recognition. So when you call into unified messaging and you want to just use your voice to say, here's the person's name, look them up, that is also gone as well as part of some of the code changes we made. But there's a lot of cool new stuff in there too that replaces that, like the new server role architecture. We've talked about that already. The new client access server, yes, it has the same name, but now it's really just doing three functions. It's a lightweight protocol proxy for HTTP, IMAP, and POP. It's an SMTP proxy for all incoming mail messages. And the third thing it does is a UM call router. So when a unified messaging caller comes in or a SIP request comes in, it will take that and then issue a SIP redirect back to the mailbox server so that the UM caller can make a connection directly there. That is all the CAS is doing now. It's completely stateless, doesn't store any exchange data whatsoever. It's just a lightweight protocol proxy. The managed store, I talked briefly about that. That's the new information store. So again, you're going to see multiple processes. You'll see a parent process. And then for every single active database that you have mounted, you will see one worker process getting instantiated. And as I mentioned, that will provide the RPC endpoint for that database. And that worker process will also provide the database cache for that database as well. Managed availability. How many of you were at my managed availability session earlier this week? All right, so for those of you who weren't there, managed availability is internal monitoring and high availability through automatic recovery actions outside of our traditional HA area, which in the context of Exchange now would be the DAG and your database copies and so forth. So it's monitoring and high availability that's been extended to things like the protocol stack, to the services, to the performance subsystem, to the event log, to dependencies like DNS and Active Directory, and basically every other Exchange component that we have. And this is, again, brand new technology that's sitting there trying to detect problems and, if possible, correcting them once they're detected. And if it can't detect the if it can't correct the problem, it has an escalation mechanism through event log generation that can notify the administrator that there's something a little bit more serious going on. And I've got some slides in the back that I'll show you how you would deal with one of those situations, how to tell what managed availability is doing. Search Foundation we talked about, that is how we've rebranded FAST. So we took the FAST technology, and now we call it Search Foundation inside of Office. And as I mentioned, both SharePoint and Exchange are using it now. And we also have a federated search API so that using the SharePoint eDiscovery Center, you can not only search SharePoint content, but you can also do eDiscovery across Exchange mailboxes and the file system and some link content as well. The Exchange Admin Center, that is the name for the new management interface that's graphical, that replaces both the Exchange Management Console and the Exchange Control Panel as well. It's web-based, so it's firewall-friendly and, of course, ready for the cloud. Outlook web app, that is all brand new, completely rewritten, including the capability to support applications within Outlook web app. We actually include some out of the box by default, things like suggested actions and Bing Maps. So if you get a mail message that looks like it has an address in it, you can have Bing Maps show up right in line in that mail message and show you a map of where that location is. Let's see here. Data loss prevention, another great new feature. We had that in Exchange 2010, but it wasn't packaged the way it is. In Exchange 2010, to do it, you had to create all the transport rules yourself and do all these different templates and policies yourself. But in 2013, we've all packaged that super nicely for you. So it's still based on transport rules, but you get built-in policies and policy templates, and you also get what we call policy tips, which are just like mail tips in Exchange 2010, except these are for DLP policies. So a policy tip might show up that says, oh, it looks like there's a credit card number in this email. Are you sure you want to send it? Those kinds of things. And of course, credit card numbers are just one type. It could be banking information, passport information, driver's license information, anything that's personally identifiable information that you wouldn't want leaked through your mail system. All of that can be protected. In-place hold and in-place e-discovery, those are evolutions of the hold and discovery features we introduced in Exchange 2010. We use the terms in-place now, though, to reinforce that all of your data is staying where it is. It doesn't need to be moved around in order to do fancy discovery or fancy hold type scenarios. It all gets to stay in place, and that saves you storage, that saves you bandwidth, and of course, it saves you time and money as well. Integration with SharePoint and Link. We've got multiple places where we integrate across them. I already talked about eDiscovery and the Federated Search API, but there's also, of course, the presence information from Link that is sprinkled all throughout Office. But then we have other features like site mailboxes, which combine an Exchange mailbox with a SharePoint site. So now you have the ability, if you create these site mailboxes, which are great for teams or projects or any use that you want, the way it works is you address an email message to the site mailbox, you add some attachments, and you click send. The attachments get stripped off and automatically stored in SharePoint. And then the mail message gets rewritten with URLs to where those attachments in SharePoint are. And you can go into this interface either way. The way I just described is starting through Outlook, but you could also go to the SharePoint site and see all the content, see all the mail messages, and do a workflow from that way as well. And with Link, some of the integration we have are things like the Unified Contact Store, where all of your contacts from Link can be stored inside your Exchange mailbox. Not only does that give you mobility, but it also gives you resiliency, assuming you're using some of the protections that we have in Exchange. And you have also the ability to archive Link content, so conversation history, meetings, and meeting attachments as well. I mentioned the anti-malware protection that's built in. Batch mailbox moves, we still allow you to do online move mailboxes, but now we give you this control in both PowerShell and the new Exchange Admin Center where you can do these things in batches. So you have a much finer control over the actual mailbox move process than you did with Exchange 2010, which was basically just blasting it all out there. Now we've got a lot more control for you in there. The namespace options, I talked a lot about that in the site resilience session a couple days ago. We now do give you the option to support a single unified worldwide namespace if you want. That's going to be a choice that's up to you and your business requirements, though. We still, of course, support the paradigm of multiple namespaces, but now we give you the option, if you want to, of just using a single global namespace for all of your URLs. Modern public folders, I mentioned that public folder databases were gone. They are, but public folders are still there. We call them modern public folders because we've modernized them. They're basically mailboxes now. And so you create as many public folder mailboxes as you want. You decide how large they should be. You decide if you want to move stuff around. And from the end user experience, the actual public folder experience is almost identical. From the administrator side, it's pretty different. Again, because there's no public folder databases and replication that you have to deal with. But you are dealing with mailboxes, and you are also dealing with a single master model. We don't have a multi-master model anymore. In other words, we don't have a writable copy of the content here and another writable content here. It's only writable in one place only. You could replicate it in a DAG, but those are passive copies, just like your mailbox database. We do have enhanced caller ID support in UM. So by that, we now have the ability to look inside all of your contacts, including custom contacts, so federated contacts from Link or Skype or LinkedIn, excuse me, or Skype or some other social network. If you integrate those contacts, then when you get a call through unified messaging, UM will also look through your own personal contacts to give you a better caller ID experience. In 2010, we would only look up in Active Directory. So if the caller was in your personal contacts, but not in AD, caller ID would not give you that information. And then workload management is an evolution of the throttling behaviors that we introduced in Exchange 2010. And the throttling behaviors are there looking at system activity, performance counter, and resources, and ratcheting up background processes or throttling them back as needed. Think of it as filling in the valleys and shaving off the peaks to make resource utilization more steady and even throughout Exchange. All right. Too much stuff for what's new. Go to that URL and you'll find even more things that are new in Exchange 2013. Now, there's some other places too. I want to get you connected into the Exchange ecosystem because it is a very vibrant and thriving and quite a mature ecosystem. Some of us have been around in the community for decades. And so I would invite all of you to check out the blog, check out these forums, check out the third-party forums as well. All of those have some very knowledgeable Exchange people in there helping to answer questions and whatnot. I see a lot of you taking photos too, which is totally fine, but this is being recorded and these slides will be downloadable too. So if you just want to kick back and relax, that's cool. Yes?
Where is it possible to
download? From the Channel 9 site, or just go to msteched.com and follow the breadcrumbs. Some other areas, there's some other forms in here as well. There's some downloads that I wanted to point out as well. The Exchange documentation, we do still create those compiled HTML help files. So once a month we'll deliver those. So if you want offline help for Exchange, once a month you'll have an updated version. You can go to the download center and get it. I mentioned data loss prevention and the policies. We also support not only the addition of updated policies, which is what that URL will take you to, but we also support third-party DLP policies as well. So you can import those into Exchange and start using those. If you need to do any diagramming of Exchange or Link or SharePoint, the Office Visio stencils are updated for the 2003 waves. For UM, there's the language packs, which you'll need if you're not using just English. And then the Exchange Web Services managed APIs also been updated as well. Any of you who are doing development against Exchange should be using Exchange Web Services, and you should be using our latest API to do that. All right. Now let's talk about some cool things you can do with PowerShell. Well, first again, let's talk about some of the things that are gone that you might be used to doing. So things like new and remove RPC client access. Remember, the old legacy CAS is gone. And also RPC over TCP connectivity for Outlook clients is also gone. And it was both those things that used the RPC client access array object in Exchange 2010. That was that load balanced object that you had to create, and then you would point your load balanced array to that object and it would reflect all of the CAS in that site. Well, that namespace and that object are gone, so the commandlets are gone with it as well. Routing group connectors are gone too, and so those commandlets are gone with it. The test system health commandlet is also gone, but there's a plethora of other commandlets that replace that functionality. Anything related to team mailboxes is gone, because team mailboxes aren't in Exchange anymore, so all those commandlets are gone. Some of the message tracking parameters have been gone, and the search dumpster parameter is gone as well. But again, there are other ways to get similar functionality. And then the get logon statistics is also gone, but I have an asterisk there because I am interested in hearing from any of you who are using that commandlet today with Exchange 2010, because we're sort of curious about the scenarios in which people use that, because we have heard feedback that folks still do have some usage for that commandlet. Quite frankly, we didn't find any real world use in our own needs, but if you have a need, I would like to hear about that, and I'll take it back to the team that owns that commandlet and see about resurrecting it. But for now, consider it gone. What's new? I'm not going to list everything that's new, because there's several hundred new commandlets and parameters in there. In fact, several hundred new commandlets, several thousand new parameters. Too many to list. In fact, in Exchange 2010, there's just under 650 commandlets. Now there's almost 940 in CU1. And in fact, we've even made changes in between RTM and CU1 as well. And we're going to be making changes in CU2. There will be some new commandlets and some new parameters coming in CU2 as well. All right, let's talk about some tools. Let's first talk about the sizing guidance, because really that is one of the most important things that you need to deal with before you can even deploy Exchange. You're not going to be able to deploy a rock solid enterprise class messaging system until you understand how to do the sizing. Now the PM, our perf guy, Jeff Mieliff, was here earlier this week doing the Exchange server sizing session. How many of you got a chance to see that? All right, about half of you, great. If you didn't get a chance to see it, or if you'd like to see it again, you can go and to that URL and visit it. And there's also one that he did for North America as well, but it's largely the same session. And in that session, I'm not going to repeat everything he did, but in that session, he talked about the process and methodology that you need to do this, the things that you need to understand about how to properly size Exchange. And of course, doing this relies on tools as well, like our server role requirements calculator. That is relatively new for Exchange 2013. We've already had a couple revisions to it. There were some bugs that we found, and so we have had some updates come out for it. There are some other, a couple other known issues that we know to be bugs that we're working on that will come out and be fixed in the next release as well. But this is really the best tool for you to do all of your sizing calculations. One of the cool things about this tool is it's doing things that we weren't able to do in Exchange 2010. For instance, this tool can output scripts that will automatically do things like build your DAG and deploy your databases and start setting everything up for you. Couldn't do that in Exchange 2010, but now we have the ability to do that in Exchange 2013 as well. So check out the calculator. That is the latest version, but again, there will be another version coming out shortly that has a couple bugs that are fixed in it. These are relatively minor bugs that are affecting mostly corner cases. So for the overwhelming majority of you, if you use the calculator that's out today and do those calculations, you shouldn't run into these things. If you do run into them, I strongly recommend using that storage calculator alias, because that will go right to the folks who build the calculator. They will be able to answer anything about it. The only other suggestion I would give you is, if you're going to ask a specific question about why does the calculator do this or that, include your actual Excel calculator file with it. So after you've done whatever it is you're doing in there, if you come up with something funny that you don't understand, email the actual calculator file itself to the storage calculator alias, because that's probably the first thing we're going to ask you for when you send that to us, is we need to see the calculator to see what it's doing. So as long as you do that from the get-go, you should get an answer pretty quickly. We monitor that DL very regularly. There's also the Exchange Server JetStress tool as well. Once you've done the sizing exercise and you've ordered your hardware, prior to going into production, you need to validate that your storage subsystem is capable of giving you all the IOPS that you need. Now, of course, we have done a lot of work over multiple versions of Exchange to reduce our IOP requirements, but we still do have them. You still need some IOPS out of your disks. Not a lot anymore, but you still need some, and you're still going to want to validate that your storage system is configured correctly and that it's producing the workload characteristics that you expect from that. Every storage vendor that we work with Exchange is very familiar with this tool. They will be able to help you set it up. They will be help you able to run the tests. They'll be able to help you evaluate the tests. And they'll be able to basically tune the tests if necessary for their particular storage environment as well. So typically, even though we have our own storage requirements and best practices, we also want you to look to the vendor for their advice and assistance as well. Again, it's downloadable. You do need to use a version that is specific to the version of Exchange that you're running. So this version right here, even though it's not the same build number, is actually the version that you would use for CU1. There was an earlier version that we released that would have been usable on RTM. So there is a binary association between the files there. You do have to use the right version. So if you ever do launch JetStress against Exchange and it gives you a cannot initialize or incorrect version or some sort of mismatch error message, you've downloaded the wrong version. You need to go get the newer one or the older one, depending on what you're running. Now, how many of you have heard of the Exchange Deployment Assistant? All right, just a few of you. The Exchange Deployment Assistant is our number one recommended tool for deploying Exchange, whether it's in a greenfield environment, a new install, or whether you're doing an upgrade from 2007 or 2010, or whether you're doing a cloud-only or a hybrid install as well. It's a web-based tool. You go to this website. You answer just a couple questions about your environment, things like, do you want single sign-on? Do you want email to go to the cloud first? Are you using unified messaging? Those kinds of things. You just answer like five or six questions at most, and then the tool will spit out step-by-step instructions that will walk you through every aspect of the deployment. Installing the software, configuring the software, creating mailboxes, or moving mailboxes in an upgrade scenario, or connecting to the cloud and so forth. And it's step-by-step instructions that not only tell you how to do things, but there's a section at the bottom of each one that says, how do I know this worked? So we give you also the steps to validate that you were successful in those steps as well. And it can be printed, it can be taken offline, those steps can be emailed, you can start over, they can be customized. It's just a fantastic tool. There is also one for Exchange 2010 as well. So if you or any of your customers might be going to Exchange 2010 for whatever reason, you can use the earlier version of the Deployment Assistant to do that as well. This link will take you to the primary Deployment Assistant page, where you'll see two links, one for the 2010 tool and a second one for the 2013 tool. Now, the Remote Connectivity Analyzer. How many of you have heard of this? This is a fantastic tool. Great, almost everybody. I'm not surprised. This is one of our best tools. This tool, if you haven't heard of it, allows you to verify connectivity from a variety of aspects from an external perspective. So things like verifying Outlook Anywhere is working, Auto Discover, SMTP email, just about any connectivity question you might have. There's IMAP and POP, there's Link and Office Communication Server as well. And we also have a downloadable version called the Microsoft Connectivity Analyzer Tool. And you can download that and run it on a system inside your own organization and basically get the benefit of having those same tests run internally and externally. And we also added a new feature to this tool as well called Message Analyzer. And what you do here is you take the headers from any of your email messages and you paste them in there, and very quickly it will break down the headers and give you an analysis of where that message came from, what hops it went through, how long it was in each hop, and so forth. And if there is, by the way, any functionality that you see might be related to stuff we're already doing, feel free, it's not on here, but at the tool site, use the feedback alias and tell us, hey, it'd be great if the tool also did this too, because that's where some of this functionality is coming from. And as you might have seen with the tool recently, we are merging all of the connectivity analyzer tools into one. So Office 365, Link, and Exchange are all going to be one tool, one-stop shopping for all of your needs. And that will be reflected in the downloadable connectivity analyzer as well. Now, there's also this Outlook connectivity tool as well. And it is largely designed for connecting Outlook to Office 365. But here's a little secret. It's actually useful for on-premises troubleshooting as well. It's totally designed and positioned for troubleshooting connectivity to the cloud, but the cloud, in our case, is still Exchange 2013, and it is the same exact code that you would be running on-premises. So all of the same troubleshooting principles and all the same error messages still apply. So if you're troubleshooting things like Outlook can't connect, or how many of you have had the Outlook repeatedly prompts for credentials problem? Yeah. Exactly. And in fact, speaking of that, let me give you a little demo of this tool. And I'm demoing it because it's pretty brand new. We only just released it a short while ago. This was created by Microsoft Support. And because it was created by Support, it's excellent at troubleshooting, because the support folks have basically encoded their experience into this tool. So anything that support would ask you, well, does this work? Did you try that? And so forth. All those questions are going to be encoded into here. So let's say, as an example, I'm just having a problem with a user mailbox. As you can see, we can work on multiple mailboxes, user, archive, and shared. So I'll click on that, and here's the things that we can troubleshoot. So Outlook connectivity is intermittent, can't configure the profile, Outlook disconnects and does not reconnect, Outlook repeatedly prompts for credentials, and Outlook has performance issues. So given the number of hands, I'm going to say Outlook prompts for credentials. So we'll click on that, and so now it's going to ask me questions. It's going to make sure that I verified some of the configurations that are required. So the first question is, well, do you have single sign-on enabled for Office 365? Because obviously without single sign-on, we're going to prompt you for credentials. With single sign-on, you put them in once, and you're good to go. But if you're not sure if you have single sign-on enabled, what do you do? How do you answer this question? Well, right here is a link. And if you were to click that link, it would take you right to the page that would tell you how to configure single sign-on and how to verify that it's working properly. So I'll pretend, yes, I've configured it fine, and I'll just say, yes, I do have single sign-on configured. So now it's going to say, okay, well, in that case, we want to run a test. So go to the Remote Connectivity Analyzer website, go to the Office 365 tab, and run that single sign-on site, and then come back to this tool and tell us if the test was successful or not. So I'm going to make this really hard for the tool. I'm going to say, well, the test was successful, which would be a secondary indicator that single sign-on was configured properly for you. So now it's going to say, okay, well, now we want to do an Outlook Anywhere test through the Remote Connectivity Analyzer. And so you would go into this dialog, and you would put in all the same information that you would do to test auto-discover and connectivity in the first place. I'm not going to go through all of these, but I'll just show you some of the simulated results of this. So in this case, I'll just say, yes, that test ran successfully. So now it's going to look for invalid or expired credentials. And it's going to tell me how to get into Credential Manager in the control panel and to see whether or not I actually have some credentials or a certificate that might be bad. And if they are bad, I have this ability to click on this link that says remove from vault. But again, let's just be tough on this tool. We'll say, did this solve your problem? No, it didn't. Okay, well, another reason we might always prompt for credentials is because you've got the checkbox that says always prompt for credentials checked. Maybe you should have checked that first. But here we are checking that now, so we're in the profile looking at that, and of course, we're going to say that no, this didn't solve our problem, so we're going to go to the next one. It says, okay, well, it's possible you don't have the proper updates installed for Outlook in order to actually run the single sign-on code. There is a minimum level of Outlook that we require in order for that to work. And so you need to go and check and see if there's any updates available for Outlook or Office that might need to be installed. And we'll say, okay, I've got all the updates. There aren't any available. This did not solve my problem. So now it's going to say, okay, well, the next thing that we would do if this were a support call is we would have you repair your profile. So go into your mail profile, run the repair process, and see if that fixes it up for you. And again, we're going to say, no, that didn't fix it for me. So now it's going to ask me if I can just create a new profile and test with that. And in this case, a new profile is a little bit trickier to actually do. So there's a video that you get to click in this tool, and you click the video, and it will actually walk you through the process of creating a new profile. Now, I would be willing to bet that everybody in this room knows how to create a profile and that you probably aren't going to need to watch this video. However, believe it or not, there are plenty of Exchange administrators on this planet who are administrating Exchange not because they're Exchange admin, but because they're the one guy who knows, one guy or gal who knows the, you know, IT a little bit, or they're a power user on their desktop, and they're not the administrator, and they might not know how to create the profiles manually. They might used to be using AutoDiscover, and, you know, they need a little help. So we have the video in there for them to do that. So the video will actually walk them through. I'm not going to play the whole thing, just a few screenshots from it. But the video will walk them through how to do that. And at the end, they will have a valid working profile that they can test against the system. And of course, watching the video didn't solve our problem either. So now the next step is we're going to look for any third-party add-ins that might be affecting things. So it's whether you're running different version of Outlook, you're going to go in there to the Trust Center or the Add-in Center and possibly remove any untrusted or unwanted add-ins. And we'll say, no, this didn't solve our problem yet. We're still looking. Now it wants you to run the Microsoft Connectivity Analyzer tool. And this is the one that you download, and you would run the test that says, I cannot log on with Office Outlook test. Once that test is done running, again, did this solve your problem? We'll just say no to that. So now you're going to be looking for limited network connectivity. That's another reason. If your network is flaky and your credentials aren't being passed properly, that can also cause repeated prompts for credentials as well. Same thing, we'll say no, this didn't solve our problem. And now, as I mentioned, there are certain levels of hotfixes that we require for Outlook. So here, it's looking for a very specific scenario where we know that without this hotfix, Outlook 2007 SP1 and later has the ability to repeatedly prompt in that case. And so we can say, no, it didn't solve that problem either. Now, it's got some other suggestions for me to use. These are Microsoft Online Service Diagnostics and Logging Tools. It wants me to download and try. Again, this could be a very tough problem to crack. We might have to do several things to do this. So I got to download this tool, generate a report, and then examine the report to see if there's any anomalies that need to be fixed. And again, if this didn't fix it, then we would look for the proper open ports. Obviously, you need to have 443 connectivity, not just to Outlook and Office365.com, but a variety of our online properties as well. And it's possible, perhaps, that you have a firewall or some other restrictions blocking access to those as well. That would also cause repeated prompts. And if that doesn't solve it, maybe it's a DNS issue. Maybe you got to check DNS and we're authenticating against the wrong server. If that doesn't solve it, maybe you were one of our BPOS customers, our Business Productivity Online Suite customers. That was a variant of Exchange Online that we had before Exchange Online. And some of our legacy BPOS customers, when they got migrated over into Office 365, some of the settings didn't come over. And if you're one of those customers, you might have to fix up some of those settings. And then if we keep saying no, then the issue ends up obviously not being resolved at that point, in which case they would either direct you to the forums or they would direct you to the online help where you can open up an actual support case. But I think you got the point that this tool will try very, very hard to fix all of the known reasons or to at least walk you through all of the known causes of whatever problem it's trying to troubleshoot, just like a support engineer would do for you on the phone. The benefit that you get here is it's free, and it's at your convenience. It's on your time, not the support engineer's time as well. And of course, we're not going to be able to solve every single problem with this tool, but as you can see, we can pretty much get all the ones that we know about. All right. How many of you are using System Center Operations Manager? All right, we do have the Exchange Management Pack out, and if you do deploy the Exchange Management Pack, that will integrate System Center Operations Manager with the managed availability components inside of Exchange 2013 and basically give you a light-up dashboard in SCOM that will expose the managed availability health sets and their current states into the System Center alerting portals. You don't need System Center with managed availability, but you definitely get a much better experience if you are using System Center. So the management pack is out there. Once that's installed, then you'll have all of the Exchange 2013 health sets exposed inside of System Center. Without the management pack, it'll just be like monitoring a generic server from System Center standpoint, which you don't want. You want the management pack in there. There's also the Office Configuration Analyzer tool, OCAT, or OFCAT, I should say. OFCAT replaces OCAT, which was the Outlook Configuration Analyzer tool. This tool is there scanning, in this case, all of Office for common configuration issues. The old tool that was just for Outlook would look for profile configuration issues. Now that Outlook test is wrapped into OFCAT, and OFCAT will check all across Office. So things like Access, Excel, Outlook, PowerPoint, and Word. So if there's any configuration issues, particularly with the new online functionality that we have inside of the Office applications, OFCAT can catch that stuff and make sure it's configured properly for you. How many of you use Microsoft Consulting Services for your engagements? All right, a few of you. So I know not all of you do, but I did want to mention it for those of you who do use MCS. The MCS engagements for Exchange 2013 now do include some custom intellectual property we created called the product line architecture. Think of it as a reference architecture for Exchange into which we have encoded all of our best practices. So the way in which we would want you to build, configure, and deploy Exchange is all encoded into this best practice set of IP, which you can purchase as part of an MCS engagement. It's very thorough and detailed stuff, which is why we're not just giving away, and you really will need an MCS consultant to walk you through it as well. But if you are using MCS, if you have a contract now and you're using it, chances are you're using the PLA architecture as the starting point for your own internal architecture. Now, it's possible that based on your own business requirements, your actual deployment topology might differ slightly. There may be some exceptions to the rules that we have encoded in here, but this will always be the starting point for that engagement. All right, let's talk about IW and calendaring. And I mentioned that Outlook web app was rewritten. One of the reasons it was rewritten is so that we could take advantage of different form factors. And there's actually three different types of views that we have now inside of Outlook web app. So one view is that traditional desktop view, the three column UI where you get the folder tree, the message tree, and then the details pane or whatever message you're selected will show up in that reading pane, if you will. But on some screens, like smaller tablets, that's a lot of real estate to take up. We don't have the luxury of being able to cram everything in like that. We want a nice, neat interface that when you press your finger on a touch display, actually touches the thing you wanted and not the thing next to it. And so that's why we have the T-wide view, which is the tablet view. That is the two-column touch. So that will be just the folder tree and the messages themselves. And then we actually also have the one column touch, or T-narrow, which is just the messages themselves. Both the reading pane and the folder tree are collapsed off to the side. And you can actually change these views on the fly. If you do *\layout=T-wide or T-narrow and press enter, it will dynamically change your Outlook web app view on the fly. We will try to detect what you're running on, and we will display the appropriate view out of the gate. But if you want to manipulate that and change the view around, you can do that by manipulating the URL in that fashion. One thing to keep in mind, though, is when you are in that T-wide environment, you don't have folder management. You do have to click on something to re-expand the folder tree, thereby putting you in a three-column view again, and then you've got folder management. But if you're on a tablet and you just need to send messages or receive messages, then the T-Wide will work great for you. Now, calendaring. We've done a lot of work around calendaring, particularly around calendar logging. And by that, I mean logging of activity that happens to calendar items. Because with the plethora of devices and operating systems and browsers and mobile devices and tablets and different things touching calendar items, we've seen historically that sometimes those calendar items are not always manipulated correctly. And sometimes the calendar items can disappear, or meetings can change, or time zones will change, and so forth. And so we wanted to have very, very robust logging so that if you were in one of those situations, you could actually dig into the logs and do some diagnostics to figure out what exactly happened. Now, the logging is actually turned on by default, cannot be turned off, but it's not super heavy logging. We've actually trimmed it down. In Exchange 2010, we would keep calendar logging for 120 days, and that could build up quite a bit. Now we only keep it for 31 days, so just slightly more than a month we can go back. Typically, though, when you're in one of those investigations, figuring out what happened with a calendar item, it's going to be something that happened yesterday or the day before, or maybe last week at most, so you won't have to dig through too many logs to figure it out. We also, in the logging details, we expose a lot of information that, as I said, using just a little bit of detective work, you could piece together a puzzle as to exactly what happened. So the most common scenario, and this is unfortunately more common than you'd think, but an executive shows up to a meeting, and they're the only one there. And they're not very happy about that. They wonder what happened. They call the help desk. And so what you do is you collect calendar logs. You're basically saying, go to the logging infrastructure, give me the calendar logs for this meeting. And ideally, you're going to connect two sets of logs, one for the meeting organizer, because they'll have the original meeting, and they're the ones who have more logging detail. And then you want to collect logs for one other attendee, not the executive, but one other attendee, because that will show you, outside of the executive's experience, what happened to that calendar item. After you collect the logs, you can run analysis on that, and the analysis will actually generate a timeline for you. So you'll be able to actually see, step by step, what happened in this item. And in this case, what happened is you find that the executive used some device, and they edited a single item, and when they did that, it caused the whole series to be deleted. But they had that single item on there, but not the whole series. So they showed up at a meeting, and no one else was there because they weren't getting any of the series changes. Okay, so these are the kinds of, yeah, exactly. These are the kinds of scenarios. This is one of the reasons that we put in this logging mechanism so you can do that kinds of things. And of course, you'd be able to go right to that executive and you can say, well, on this specific day, you edited this item from this device. And when you did that, it doesn't mean that they did something wrong, but something happened and caused the whole series to disappear. And that's why no one else was at that meeting. All right. Some other improvements that we've done are around calendar repair. Now, calendar repair is not entirely new. We had that in 2010. And it goes behind the scenes and it fixes up meeting entries that it believes to be wrong. So, for instance, if an attendee inadvertently drags a meeting somewhere lower on their calendar, because the organizer's meeting hasn't changed, none of the other attendees' meeting hasn't changed, the calendar repair assistant will detect that and automatically fix it up and move that meeting back to where it should be. And similar things, if someone accepted a meeting request and for whatever reason that meeting dropped off their calendar, it can pop back on. Or if the reverse happens, they didn't get the meeting but the organizer sent them out, that can also detect that scenario and fix that up as well. We do have some improvements to the logging as well. So if you saw the logs we were generating in Exchange 2010, they look a little different in 2013. Lots more information in there, particularly not just what failed to validate, but reasons why it failed to validate as well. All right, let's talk about transport. Transport has changed in a number of ways, but one thing I want to point out is this new metric that we have called queue velocity. Has anybody heard of queue velocity yet? It's brand new in Exchange 2013. Well, as its name implies, queue velocity is a visual queue. It's a numeric value that you can look at so that when you do something like get queue and you're looking at that in PowerShell, you can tell at a glance how well your queue is working. So a queue velocity, for instance, of zero, you can see the calculations we have up here, indicates that the queue is draining successfully. Any queue velocities with a negative number could indicate that your queue is filling faster than it's draining. So when you're factoring in queue velocity, and there's a variety of factors that go in, it's basically the incoming or outgoing rate over a set period of time. When this calculation is run, though, you don't just want to look at the actual velocity count that it gives you, because message count is also important. You could have, for example, a negative queue velocity and a high message count, and you might expect that because there's so many messages, of course the queue is going to slow down. But if you have a negative queue velocity and a low message count, that means there's something wrong in transport. Transport is having a problem processing those messages and getting them out of the queue in time. And that is something that should get your attention and that you want to go looking at right away. So get queue is exposed, or queue velocity is exposed here in get queue. You can see this velocity counter right up there. And as I mentioned, there's never going to be a positive queue because obviously messages cannot leave faster than they're coming in. That's impossible. But they could leave slower than they're coming in, and that's what the negative queue indicator looks like. Any queue velocity of zero, that means you've got a balanced queue. Messages are leaving the queue as fast as they're coming in. But if you see that negative rate right here, like you do down here, then you would want to look over at the next column and see how high your message count is. Now, in my case, those are simulated numbers. Those aren't real. I wouldn't expect a negative Q value with a message Q of 2 in that case. Now, it could be, though, that it's not necessarily a problem with your transport engine. It could be, in this case, it's in a retry state because the destination server is unreachable. So, of course, the messages aren't going to leave the queue and the queue will build up. And that could also cause a negative queue velocity to show up. But through normal operations, assuming all the receiving servers are accepting normally, the queue velocity will be your best indicator as to how efficient and how well your queues are performing on a minute-by-minute basis, which is how we do the calculations. So you could do get queue once, get a velocity for that minute, come in 5 or 10 minutes later, run get queue again, get a completely different velocity number based on what activity has occurred. One thing to keep in mind with get queue, though, get queue is great for Exchange 2013 and Exchange 2010, but it won't work for Exchange 2007. So if you are in a coexistence environment between 2013 and 2007, you'll need to go back and use Queue Viewer through the Exchange 2007 toolbox in order to see 2007 queues. Now, it doesn't really matter that get queue doesn't work on 2007 because it doesn't expose queue velocity there anyway. Queue velocity only exists in 2013, but get queue is still convenient for managing Exchange 2010 queues. All right, some other things that we've done is queue logging. And we, again, have put in extensive logging in here so that from a diagnostic perspective, we can tell what happened in the system and we can sort of figure things out based on the activity in the logs. The logs themselves, you can see where they're kept at. It's a CSV text file. We do take a snapshot of that transport queue every 60 seconds, and that cannot be turned off. And so, as you might imagine, with all of these queues and things that we're doing, we require a bit more disk space on your Exchange servers with 2013 than we did in previous versions. Again, simply to hold all this stuff. Now, the queue logging that we do, that will get all of your internal queues, except it's not going to get any empty ones. It's not going to do your shadow queues, so none of the shadow redundancy queues will be exposed, and no poison queues will be exposed as well. So in addition to shadow queues, that's not just shadow redundancy. Also, the safety net queue will also not be exposed as well. All right, here's an example queue log entry. And I want to point out one thing in particular. See where this last line is up there where it says attempted failover E and that it ends abruptly with that quote? That is not a typo. The actual queue logging entry, for whatever reason, is limited to 54 characters. It's a weird number, weird reason, I don't know why. So that is the expected message in that case because that's where 54 characters ended. So when you see these log entries, and if it looks like the message is cut off, that's intentional and by design. It's not a typo, it's not a failure of queuing, it's just limited to 54 characters. But here in this case, we get enough of the information here. We can see it was a 2-1 message, unable to connect. So we know that that's why we're not delivering, in this case, to contoso.com, because we're trying to connect to the IP address we got from DNS. As you can see, the DNS connector delivery retry, it's just not answering. So there's nothing for us to do in this case. The queue will just stay in a retry state until the receiving server is ready to send it. All right. Let's talk about search discovery and e-compliance. So, couple things about search basics, particularly when you're installing Exchange. If you do not install the Office filter pack before you run Exchange setup, setup will generate a warning. It's not an error, it's a warning. However, because setup generates a warning from a documentation perspective, we treat that as a requirement for installing Exchange. But the fact of the matter is that the Search Foundation technology that we're using already has the majority of filters, the iFilters, built into it natively so that it can index all these different file types. Of course, Office file types and whatnot. But there are a couple file types that the Office filter pack has that the Search Foundation doesn't have natively. And those specifically are the ability to index OneNote and Publisher files in transport. If you need that ability, then you would install the Office Publisher, the Office Filter Pack, and you're good to go. If you don't need that ability, it's technically not required for you to install the Office Filter Pack. It's not going to harm anything if you do install it and don't use the functionality. It's not going to damage the iFilters that Search Foundation comes with. It's simply going to ignore them. And of course, we do support third-party iFilters as well, but we don't support custom ones like we used to previously. So the third-party ones have to be adhere to our spec, and they have to be something that comes from like a vendor like Adobe is a common one. Their PDF iFilter is one of the more common ones. But if you're trying to make your own custom iFilters, you can't do that anymore. All right, in terms of message attachment processing, there are some cases in which search is not getting through all of the messages. And that could be because maybe it's too deep, or there's too many attachments, or not enough resources available. You actually have control over how much work the search engine will do. And you can control that through these registries, things like controlling the maximum number of attachments, or the maximum attachment depth, which would be a message and a message and a message, and that embedded message has an attachment in there, or it could be for skipping things that are partially processed. You have total control over that stuff now, unlike Exchange 2010, where it would either index something or it wouldn't. Yes, sir?
So if I change this or one of these parameters, are they resetted when I do a cumulative update?
Yes. They are. This would be one of the custom entries that would get overwritten. Yes. These entries exist by default. So if it was an entry that didn't exist by default, that we have code where you were adding a registry key and then adding a value, that would persist. But if it's a registry we programmatically add in setup that you manipulate, we overwrite that because we're hard-coded for those values out of the box. Great question. Thank you. Now, search. Search has a lot of processes that go with it, and it needs a lot of memory. Search is one of the bigger reasons that our CPU and memory requirements are much larger than they were in Exchange 2010. But when you're looking at the search processes, they're all called noderunner.exe. So how do you know what's doing what? Because there's actually different components. There's a component for the administrator interface. There's a component for the content interface. There's a component for the indexing itself. And there's a separate process component that does the querying itself. And what you can do is you can actually look inside of Task Manager. I think that should be on the next slide. You can look inside of Task Manager, and if you add the path column so that you see the full explicit path of that process, you will see things like admin node or content engine node or index node or interaction engine node, and that will tell you what process is for what. So say, for instance, you see one of those processes running away, and you do some investigation in Task Manager, and you figure out it's the interaction engine node 1. Well, that just means that there's a heavy query going on. That's the query interface right there. If you saw something like index node 1, that means there's a lot of indexing going on. That's what that process is doing right there. And of course, there could be other interfaces, things that come from e-discovery, and things that come from administrator work as well. But this is the best way when you're looking at Task Manager and all you see is a bunch of noderunner.exes. This is how you tell which is which and what's doing what task. Now, in terms of eDiscovery, eDiscovery uses keyword query language. That's the language that Search Foundation uses. And it is very similar to the query languages you've used in previous versions, but it's not entirely the same. And because it's not the same, I wanted to include this quick little cheat sheet that had some syntaxes and examples for you that show most of the common searches you would be doing. So there will be a little bit of a learning curve for you to use the new search technology. And we're talking about searching through eDiscovery. So that would be through the Exchange or the SharePoint portal. The searches that you would do through Outlook web app or through the Outlook client, those use the same syntax. This is the eDiscovery syntax that has changed. All right, modern public folders. How many of you are using public folders today? All right, how many of you are interested in using modern public folders in 2013? Wow, almost as many hands. That's great. Well, they have been modernized. They are all now mailbox-based. We don't have those public folder databases, as I said, and there's no public folder replication anymore. There is, of course, the same user experience, so the users get the public folder hierarchy, and they can add folders and remove folders, and of course, put content into them. But behind the scenes, each one of those folders lives in a unique mailbox, and it's up to the administrator to figure out where that's going to be and determine how large those mailboxes are going to be and things like that. Now, behind the scenes, there's a lot of work going on to sort of mimic that user experience. So, for instance, when a user does make a hierarchy change, that is intercepted immediately and then replicated through all of your public folder mailboxes. Even though the content lives in one place, we do replicate the hierarchy everywhere. So we do still have kind of this concept of a public folder home mailbox, and that is just going to be a public folder mailbox that is close to the Outlook user so that they can very quickly get the public folder tree. And of course, when they choose a particular folder in that tree, they will then be directed to the mailbox that hosts that content. Now, modern public folders, there is a migration path. It's a cutover migration. In fact, we've talked about it this week. There's a lot of stuff on TechNet about it. And there is a rollback process. If you move to modern public folders and you decide you don't like them, you can roll back if you want, but be aware that that rollback process is difficult and it's manual and it requires you to export all of the new and changed data in modern public folders and manually put them back into your legacy public folders. So keep that in mind. There is a rollback plan, but it is very difficult and it could be prone to data loss if you don't do that properly. Now, here's some quick PowerShell liners to show you how to get information about public folders. You can see, for instance, which public folder has up-to-date copies of the hierarchy. Hopefully all of them should, but that first one will show you too. If you want to see which public folder have content, you can just use that second one, and that will show you only the public folders that have content in it. Any other public folder that doesn't show up would be empty, and if you wanted to, you could just delete it from the system at that point. You can also move public folder between content, just like you can move mailboxes between mailbox databases. But this is actually moving data between mailboxes themselves. One thing to keep in mind here, it's kind of a pain to do this, because every folder that you need to move has to be spelled out explicitly. So, for instance, you can't just move a parent and have all of its children move with it. You have to explicitly call out the parent and each one of its children folders, like I've done up here in this example. So you can see I'm moving folders, folder one, and then the other folder is folder one slash child one. So child one is a child of folder one, and I have to move them both like that in order to do that. The other thing to be aware of is when you are doing these moves, we only allow you to do one move at a time. So you have to wait till this move is completed before you could kick off another move after that. So keep that in mind. If you're planning on whole scale moving a bunch of stuff around, it has to be done serially. It cannot be done in parallel. Now, of course, if you're moving a bunch of stuff from the same source to the same target, then you can do it as I've done above, just by separating each folder with a comma. But if you're going from multiple sources to either the same or multiple targets, that are separate, those are separate moves that have to be done individually. Now, one other thing to keep in mind with public folder routing. For those of you using mail-enabled public folders, only one type of public folders can exist at any given time. So you're either using legacy public folders or you're using modern public folders. You cannot use them both concurrently. During the migration, particularly when the legacy public folders get locked, mail messages that come in, they won't have a place to be delivered to. So they'll be stuck in the message queues and you won't be able to hit retry and force them out. You'll actually have to wait until your migration is complete and you've enabled modern public folders. And then once that is done, then you can go and restart the transport service on every server that has messages stuck in the queue, and those messages will automatically get redirected to your modern public folders. So of course, when you're doing the modern public folder migration, things like permissions and any email addresses that you have for those public folders will carry over with it as well. So just keep in mind, it's known and expected that messages going into mail-enabled public folders are going to get stuck during the migration, and you'll be able to unstick them once the migration is done and you've unlocked the modern public folders. All right. Recovering deleted modern public folders. That is somewhat similar to recovering hidden deleted items. It's a little bit trickier than saying going into recover deleted items from a mailbox, because when you delete a public folder, we actually stick it in the non-IPM subtree and we hide it from you. So what you can do is you can actually do set public folder, and you're going to take the path to it, which would be this non-IPM subtree slash dumpster root slash whatever folder name you have, and then the path would be the new target folder, which would be the public folder mailbox you want to move it back into. So keep in mind, things that get deleted from modern public folders, they're still in the dumpster, but you have to manually move them back through PowerShell. There's no GUI to do that. All right, let's talk about managed availability. Let's see how we're doing on time. Wow. Are you serious? Wow, 6:19, huh? Well, we were supposed to end 4 minutes ago. Well, this is why I stand here and not look at that clock, because I don't want to be pressured. So we have asked the experts right after this. I will not be insulted if folks want to get up and go to ask the experts right away and, you know, start drinking. But I'm more than prepared and happy to keep going through this. So if you want to sit around, we just have a few more slides to go through. So if you don't want to sit around and you leave, I will not take offense. Wait, where are you going? No. What? Seriously? No, I'm kidding. Seriously, anybody, feel free to leave if you need to. I totally understand. But this is kind of some interesting stuff. So if you are leaving, I strongly recommend downloading the slide deck so you can get these script examples. Because managed availability is very new and different. And there's a lot of stuff going on. I mentioned in my session earlier this week that every second we're evaluating hundreds of metrics on the server. And so the idea is, it's great that managed availability can take care of stuff and fix stuff for us, but you also kind of want to know what it's doing behind the scenes. So we do have some management commandlets that you have. These are really the only ones that you'll ever use: get health report, the server health ones, the monitoring identity, and the overrides as well. Again, download the managed availability session from earlier and you'll get a lot of this stuff. But the primary things I wanted to show you is just some examples as you can get some health information out of your servers. We did post a blog post yesterday on the Exchange Team blog that talked very basically about how to do this stuff and had a couple of these examples. But I also wanted to point out that we also now have this ability to use this dash rollup group parameter as well. And what that does, it will take a whole health set group and roll up the health into one nice one-liner report for you as well. So if you're just interested in a summary of what the health of the group is, you can get that through that rollup as well. And in fact, using this last script one up here, where we're doing get database availability group, what we're doing there is we're actually getting all of the servers that are members of that DAG, and then we're piping it out to the health report, and that will give us a nice rollup of that group of servers. So just at a glance with this one liner, I'll know what the health and status of my DAG members are from a managed availability perspective. Now, if a server is unhealthy, you can use that next one to find out why. You use get server health, give it the server name, give it the health set, and you'll know which health set it is because it'll be the one that says unhealthy. And then that will pipe out all of the components of that health set and give you an idea as to which component is failing and therefore why it's unhealthy. So let's walk through some of this stuff. Now, as I mentioned before, anything that managed availability is going to do, it's going to log in the Crimson Channel event log. This, in this case, it's going to be in the Recovery Actions Managed Availability log. So it's going to go in there, log all that. When managed availability starts an action, that will be event 500. When it completes that action, whether it was successful or not, that will be event 501. So you'll always know what managed availability did or tried to do. So all the actions that managed availability doing are completely accessible through the event viewer, but rather than wade through the event viewer, you can use some of these PowerShell scripts that I have here to interrogate the Crimson Channel event viewer and get this information for yourselves through the command line. So these are all one-liners. They're word wrap for readability. So the first one, as you can see up there, we're just getting the event log for the Crimson Channel itself. So we've defined this variable, recovery. In fact, I'll point to it on the mouse. This variable right here, this recovery action results events. And all we're doing is using the get win event to interrogate a specific event log for information. And then the next one we're doing is put in more information in the events in the XML view than that's in the general details view. So it's the XML view of these events that are really going to provide you with all the details of what managed availability is doing. So we take that alias and we get all the events through that, and then we process it through an XML reader. So we're using PowerShell's native XML format in this case. And then we get a nice XML setting of what that looks like. When you look at one of these events in the event log, there's a whole bunch of items that are going to be relevant and of interest to you. Some of the most important ones are going to be things like the requester name, which component requested this action take place. So why did the replication service start yesterday? That's the premise that we're going to start with this small exercise. We know that sometime yesterday, the replication service restarted itself, and we want to find out why. So the first thing I'm going to do is we're just going to run that one-liner there, and we're going to interrogate the Crimson Channel event log using that recovery actions results XML that we got from the other scripts. And we're looking for the MS Exchange REPL, that's the replication service, and we're looking for just a few information like the start time and requester name. And what we'll get is output that looks like this. We'll see the time at which the requester started, and we'll see the name of the requester, this Service Health MS Exchange REPL Endpoint Restart. Very, very long. This is why you want to do this in the shell. Once you have that information, then the next thing you want to do is find out what responder triggered that. So we're going to define another alias called define responders. And again, we're going to look in this case in the responder definition event log, which is where we keep all of our define responders. And once we have all the responder definitions, then we can interrogate their health. And we're specifically looking for that responder that we saw on the other slide, this Service Health MS Exchange REPL Endpoint Restart. So we're looking for that, and we basically just need two pieces of information out of it. We need the name of it, and we need the alert mask, because the alert mask will tell us what probe launched it. So once I had that information, the name, as you can see, is the same name that we were looking for, and now you can see we have the endpoint monitor that triggered that responder. So now we know the responder, and now we know the monitor. So let's back off a little bit more. Because we're getting information out of the Crimson Channel again, I just need to look now at the monitor definitions event log. So you might have noticed that the script is not really changing. All we're doing is just looking at a different event log. So at this point, now that I have the monitor definition, I need to see what probes can trigger that monitor. And that's what I'm using this bottom one for. So now I'm searching the probe definition event log for the one that has the Service Health MS Exchange REPL Endpoint Probe. Once I find that, this is the output that I get. I get three different probes, one which is a server locator, one which checks RPC connectivity, and a third probe which checks TCP connectivity. And you can see the target resource was the replication service on there. So now we want to interrogate the probes. And to do that, I just get the probe error messages, which, again, you'll find in the event log. So here, I'm going into the probe result event log. And I'm looking for, again, that Service Health MS Exchange REPL Endpoint Probe. And once I have that information, it will give me all of the XML information that contains the error messages. But it's going to give that to me in the command shell. And I don't want it in the command shell because it's going to be XML and there's going to be a lot of columns. And so I would like it formatted prettier. So to get that graphical view of the output, I'm going to take the output from this commandlet and pipe out some of the values here and then pipe that out again to this out grid view. And when I do that, I end up with this nice little grid view of information, and you can see things here that say why the RPC task list listener failed, or what the exceptions were. These are the actual error messages encountered by the probes as they attempted to validate that the service was running. And so you can see here at a glance that the listener checks didn't pass. We tried to make a call and no one answered. Okay, why did no one answer? Whoops, because the service was stopped. That's why no one answered. And managed availability detected that the service was stopped and restarted it automatically in the middle of the night without an administrator needing to intervene. So that's how you backtrack managed availability. One other thing I want to talk about with respect to managed availability is for those of you using journaling. Some of the probes that we use, in particular the SMTP probes, they send mail messages to do their tasks. In the managed availability session, one of the examples I showed repeatedly was the Outlook web app test that we do, where we're using the OWA protocol to send messages to those mailboxes. If you are using journaling, it's possible that those messages will be captured by your journaling system, and they'll start to fill up your journal mailbox. Okay? There's two ways that you can get around that. One is to use global journaling, which doesn't have that problem. The other way, though, is to go ahead and set an override on managed availability so that those messages simply don't get journaled by the system as well. Either one is a more than viable workaround for you, and whichever one you choose is up to you. But just be aware that if you are using journaling and you're not using global journaling, managed availability will unfortunately start filling up your journaling mailbox with all of that kind of stuff. All right, so that's it. That's all I had. I was going to say I'll take questions now, but I'm just going to pack up and head down to Ask the Experts. So I would love for all of you to join us there. And if not, I'm sure most of you have my contact info. Feel free to send me email messages if you do have any other questions. And I'll also be at the Exchange booth tomorrow as well. So thanks for staying a little longer than expected, and enjoy your evening.